Affairs for Thursday, April 2nd, 2009. I'm going to take the bills slightly out of order today, just because I think there's some people here for one of them who might not want to sit through the rest of the committee today. So I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 377 and let everyone know that despite our best intentions, this is not quite ready, and so I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 377. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 515. And Lori, if you would like to give us an overview, please. We heard testimony on this bill a while back, and there's been a work group, and there's a couple of amendments to consider today.
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee, you should have the dash 1 and dash 2 amendments. There will be additional amendments, we've heard, but you have the dash 1s. Speaking to the dash 1s, they make some technical revisions. They restore certain statutory language. This has to do with Lemon Law work group amendments, I think, mainly. Clarifies the reasonable allowance for use provisions. It clarifies the nonconformity provisions and specifies that a manufacturer, agent, or authorized dealer of manufacturer is given one attempt to conform the vehicle to warranty if the nonconformity is likely to cause death or serious bodily injury. It revises some of the informal dispute settlement provisions. It reduces the statute of limitations provisions from 2 years to 1 year after 24,000 miles reached or 2 years after delivery of vehicle, whichever ends earlier. Then the dash 2s build on the dash 1s and add some additional informal dispute disclosure provisions and adds a requirement that the manufacturer, agent, or authorized dealer provide the consumer with an itemized statement or repair order, and then it specifies the contents of that.
Thank you so much. And I have a couple people signed up, Craig Campbell, Keith Dabanovich, and Emily, did you want to come up as well to answer any questions? Okay. You want to come on up, all three of you come on up at the same time? We believe in efficiency.
As long as we don't talk at the same time.
Yes, we do. Thank you. And Craig, you're signed up first, so do you want to...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of General Motors. I'm going to make my comments brief. My client is still reviewing the amendments, but I did want to thank the chair and the member of those folks who worked in the work group. Although, obviously, we're not in agreement with everything that came out of the work group, it was a positive experience, and it certainly made the bill a better bill for us. And I just wanted to get that on the record, and we'll obviously be in contact with you if there's any specific concerns that came out as a result of the amendments, but wanted to thank everyone for working with us on that.
Thank you so much. Keith?
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, my name is Keith Dabanovich, Special Counsel for the Attorney General. I would echo my colleague's comments. He and I and other members of interested parties, both industry and consumer people, got together on two occasions. There was a very spirited discussion, and I think it was, frankly, a very fruitful discussion. There were changes to the bill that improved the bill, but they preserved the protections for consumers. From our perspective, some of the key elements are the branding of the title that remains in, and industry was very helpful in recognizing that that was helpful to consumers, and frankly, it's a protection for them as well. The modifications, we kept the 2 year or 24,000 mile provision, but that was changed to whichever occurs first. And that was something that industry requested. We had a good debate over that, and I recall Senator George's comments and questions about that issue. And we went around and around and recognized that we needed to have some reasonable limitation, and so that was something that was modified in the bill. We also discussed the proper definition of what is a lemon, and you know, within what period of time, as I indicated, that the lemon issue needs to arise, and how many times does it need to be fixed. And we agreed upon three times. If you try to get it fixed three times and it's not fixed, it's a lemon. If a car is out of service for 30 days or more, it's a lemon. or if it involves something that presents a risk to life or limb, and it has been attempted to be fixed once but couldn't be repaired, that's a lemon as well. And these are all things that, frankly, I think everyone on the committee, the work group, agreed with. We also reached an agreement on a clear formula for calculating the value of a vehicle if it needs to be returned and thus the money refunded to the consumer. And that's good for both consumer and industry so that there's no discrepancy, no dispute about what the return value is. And that's a pretty clear formula. It's based upon the number of miles multiplied times the value of the vehicle. And the also one thing that industry was quite concerned about was to be able to preserve the dispute resolution mechanism that a lot of the companies already have. And that was a topic that we also debated and felt that given that a lot of the claims are indeed resolved with no expense to the consumer as a result of the industry-provided dispute resolution process, we felt that that ought to be allowed to remain in existence. It does not obviously prohibit a consumer from resorting to the court system, but it certainly is an adjunct that is a less expensive revenue avenue should the consumer want to pursue the claim independently of the court system. So I would echo the comments to my colleague to the right who believe that this is a good improvement on the bill. We agree and thank the chair and her staff for having done a tremendous job of bringing us together to work on this bill.
Thank you so much. Emily, would you like to add comments about the amendments and what they do? Because I know you've spent a lot of time working on them.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Emily Kincher. For the record, I serve as staff to Senator Suzanne Bonamici, District 17. I think that the testimony before me outlined the changes to the bill relatively well. We came to consensus. We heard from both sides, and we tried to find some middle ground, so I think we did a pretty good job there. We are still working. There are different parts of the industry that we heard from as well. We heard from motorcycle dealers and manufacturers. We heard from RV dealers and manufacturers. We're still working on implementing language for a model lemon law that they've been working, a national work group has been working on for the past decade. It's pretty exciting that we're going to be able to put that language into law because we will be the first state to do so, if it passes, of course. And I'm here to answer any questions about the amendments.
Thank you. I wanted to ask about, and probably Keith would be the one to ask, you gave us a stack of complaints about lemon law alleged violations that came into the Department of Justice. Do you have a sense about whether the changes that we're making in these amendments would address most of the concerns that were raised in those complaints?
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, absolutely. Obviously, one of the things that we look at to help us learn about what law improvements might be necessary are the complaints that we receive from consumers. The provisions that allow that are clear on what is a lemon and you know how much time they have to return the vehicle, those are extremely important. Indeed, we've had a number of cases where people have come to us and said, geez, this problem arose on the 13th or 14th month, and they would have been outside the original bill. I'm sorry, outside the existing law. These amendments provide additional protections to consumers, and as a consequence, that's why we're supportive.
Thank you. And then also I wanted to ask, Emily, if you could sort of walk through the Dash 2 amendments, because this is something that arose when we were talking with Danielle Bouvois. I never pronounce her name.
Beauvais.
I don't speak French, and I think it shows. who was represents people in lemon law cases, and she was saying that frequently she ran across instances where the consumer would take the vehicle in but not have documentation that a repair attempt was made. And so if you could talk a little bit about the Dash 2 amendments and what this is intended to address.
Sure. The Dash 2 amendment actually does three things, and we We wanted to create some clarity to reduce any confusion in a case when a lemon law dispute does arise. The first portion, it's marked on page 3 after line 25, states that the manufacturer or the dealer has to provide written description of if a person wants to file a lemon law complaint, their car has been repaired 3 times, there's an opportunity to cure, but they think that the car might be a lemon, they have to provide written notification of such to the manufacturer. And so this just requires that the manufacturer in the manual tells them how to do so. So there's clarity there. The second portion after line 36 does the same if there is a lemon law dispute and the customer is going to activate the informal dispute resolution procedure that the manufacturer has. This section requires that the manufacturer tell them how to do so. It says here in writing, of course, that seems to be in the manual or any other way. And then the last portion, which you mentioned, Chair Bonamici, section 11, states anytime the manufacturer or the dealer takes the car back to be repaired on this potential lemon law defect, they have to provide them with certain, this is what we did, this is how many miles we drove the car in testing to make sure that the defect was repaired, so on and so forth. So this just states that the dealer has to provide them with this information so that they'll have it in the case of a lemon law dispute.
Thank you very much. Questions? Committee members? No? Well, thank you very much. Is there anyone else here today to testify about Senate Bill 515? And we do expect that the other amendment will be to us fairly soon. It will be... unfortunately, a little lengthier than these because it's based on a model national lemon law for RVs, and we'll be taking a look at that. As Emily said, it hasn't been implemented by any states yet because the timing was fortuitous. It was finished just about the time that we began our work group, so we'll be taking a look at that and recognizing that RVs are unique and don't necessarily have the same characteristics as cars. So we'll get that back up as soon as we get that amendment. And so I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 515 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 875. Lori?
Yes. Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 875 has a very simple description. It prohibits a landlord from charging a fee or a deposit for an assistance animal in rental housing. You have before you the no revenue impact statement up here at the dais, as well as a revised fiscal statement, which is why your SMS is revised up on top, because legislative fiscal indicated there is a minimal fiscal impact and they did not issue a separate statement.
Thank you very much. We also have before us Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and it's great to see you looking from this direction. You look great. So I'm here just to do a brief introduction to Senate Bill 875. My co-sponsor, Senator Walker, had a conflict and could not be here today, but also sends her support for the bill. You will, I'm sure, remember, because this happened pretty recently in our February session, that we passed a bill that gave the Bureau of Labor and Industries, our state agency, the authority to process housing complaints, which had formerly been processed much farther away and with longer delay by the federal government. And in order to be able to take on that responsibility, it has been necessary to make some changes to Oregon state law to ensure that our fair housing laws were not in conflict with the federal laws. So this bill is just another example of that sort of change. This deals with fees that are charged for assistance animals by landlords, and basically the bill just makes changes necessary to have state law be in conformity with federal law. There are experts who are about to testify much more capably than I could begin to on the technical details of that, but that's essentially why the bill is before you, and it does need to be passed in order to preserve our state's ability to timely and efficiently process these claims. So I would be happy to answer any questions, but I think they'd probably be better left for some of the other witnesses.
But it's an opportunity,
yeah.
So.
It's like, do we get cheap shots right now? She's on the stand.
Questions for Senator Rosenbaum?
I'll wait for the technical.
Thank you for your testimony. I'm going to have, I think, two of you at a time, perhaps, since we have four people. So I'll have Bob Estabrook and Norton Cabal. Cabal. Welcome. Bob, you want to go first?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Bob Estabrook from the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We strongly support Senate Bill 875 because, as you just heard from Senator Rosenbaum, it is an important piece of legislation that we need in order to maintain our substantial equivalency with federal law and to be able to enforce fair housing complaints here in the state of Oregon. I want to make just three very brief points. You also have written testimony from the Bureau, but some of the things that aren't highlighted in that testimony. As I said, this is a critical piece of legislation for us in order to maintain our substantial equivalency with federal law. That's something where we get certified by the Federal Housing and Urban Development Department, and quite honestly, their word is law, or at least it's good enough for us. So very important that we maintain the substantial equivalency and be able to enforce those complaints here. I do want to make a note about enforcement. There's been an issue identified. As you'll note from the bill, the changes that are being made are in ORS Chapter 346, which is not a chapter that BOLI normally has much of anything to do with. Normally, we enforce fair housing and disability law through Chapter 659A. But in Chapter 346, there is currently language prohibiting additional fees or excessive deposits being charged to renters with service animals. And currently, we enforce through 659A the federal Housing and Urban Development Department's position that is there shall be no fees and no deposits charged for service animals because they are not considered to be a pet. It's a reasonable accommodation issue. However, the existence of the statute in Chapter 346 raises some confusion and some questions because it is separate and apart from our standard enforcement statutes. And I think the issue that has been raised to us is, okay, so if this is existing in another part, another chapter of statute, does that constitute a conflicting set of policy? Does it do anything that is helpful? And I think that we're going to have to resolve that question probably separate from this bill. The reason that we want to do it separate from this bill is we're really talking about comparing not just these particular words that HUD has told us thou shalt fix in order to maintain substantial equivalency, but a question of whether Chapter 346 is complementary to 659A, or if it's, you know, at best it is probably duplicative, at worst it generates confusion and potential conflict, and we're going to work very hard with the advocates who've raised this issue to resolve that. Separate from Senate Bill 875, we would strongly urge your support for the bill as it's written, recognizing that we will have some other additional future work to do to resolve all of the issues.
Thank you very much.
Norton. Senator Bonamici and members of the committee, thank you very much for having me. My name is Norton Cabal. I'm the legislative director for Oregon Rental Housing Association, which is a landlord trade group that represents about 5,000 landlords around the state. Why we should be here talking about what is a very sleepy Chapter 346? Seems to be nobody pays any attention to this, although I do. In fact, I was instrumental in bringing this to BOLI's attention, the contradiction between what's in this statute and what's in others. And I do lots of trainings for landlords around the state. It's part of what I do. And I'm continually get this one thrown in my face. It says we cannot charge excessive deposits because that means we can charge extra deposits. So I think this fix is absolutely essential, and I support it strongly. We tried to make just this small technical fix. We did not try to change the world. Chapter 346, I would remind you, is titled Programs for Persons Who Are Blind or Deaf. It is not our fair housing non-discrimination statutes, and I would not like to try to incorporate all of that into this. So I'm nervous about amending this further, which I know there's a proposal to do, because I think that needs to be vetted and dealt with very carefully. Nobody's rights are being infringed by the bill as it is proposed right here. And so we don't need to rush to create additional rights for anybody because those rights are already protected in Chapter 659A. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I read the bill, and it looks like it applies only to blind people who are blind or deaf or have a physical impairment. And I guess my question is, how are these service animals, I mean, are they certified or defined in elsewhere in the statute? In other words, I think the bill is limited enough so someone couldn't just come in and say, this is my service animal, and just have that stand. What kind of sideboards are there?
Madam Chair and Senator Burdick, the short answer to your question is the definitions in ORS 346, they talk about a service animal being trained to assist a person with an impairment that affects a major life activity. It's got similar, although not entirely equivalent, language to the disability law in 659A. I think that this highlights one of the difficulties with this particular part of Chapter 346, which is that it's not entirely clear. It is not written to be very clear that it is tied specifically to disability law, specifically to landlord-tenant law. It exists in sort of a gray area, and I think that that's some of the confusion that we definitely want to get resolved. But the reason that 875 is so critical is to eliminate the immediate issue that that HUD sees with this.
I would add, Senator Burdick, Senator Bonamici, there's a big, broad array of fair housing protections, and this chapter reaches out to just part of them, people with physical disabilities. It does not address people with mental disabilities. It does not address other kinds of animals that people get, therapy animals, assistance animals, companion animals. It doesn't address any of that. But all of that is addressed in 659A. So not having that here doesn't do any harm because it's already covered by another statute.
So are you saying this other, Madam Chair, to follow up, are you saying that this other statute has these same requirements? For example, if someone came in and they said, I have these three dogs that provide my, comfort against anxiety, that the landlord has no recourse to charge any kind of deposit?
Madam Chair and Senator Burdick, it is in actually the rules that are promulgated by Boley related to this issue are where we address animals. They're not specifically covered in 659A, but the statement in statute in 659A is about making a reasonable accommodation to afford a disabled renter full enjoyment of the accommodation. And that line, which is the same as what appears in federal law, has been interpreted by the Housing and Urban Development Department to mean that if the animal is an assistance animal and is necessary to allow that individual the full enjoyment of those facilities, that then it is a reasonable accommodation, and on the basis of that reasonable accommodation that the landlord cannot charge a fee or deposit for that service animal.
Okay, and follow up, Ms. Madam Chair. And then what if the animal does damage? How is the landlord supposed to get that paid for?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, it's specifically stated in statute that if there's damage done to the premises, that the owner is liable for that damage, even though
the owner of the animal.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, the owner of the animal is liable for any damage to that property caused by their animal.
So this particular thing just applies to blind, deaf, and physically disabled people, correct?
This particular statute, yes.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator George?
Thank you. My question is exactly the last question that Senator Burdick had, and so I just want to ask you why, since it's not exactly clear of whether or not you can charge an additional fee if there's damage to the residents. And I want to ask you, when it was being written, it seemed like to me it'd be better if it said, a person who is blind may not be required to pay an additional fee or deposit for a guide dog because what it implies, what it sort of implies here is that that if you're charged a fee that is, or a deposit that is refundable based on damage, but if the dog created the damage, then you in essence couldn't charge that fee. I mean, that, you could almost interpret it that way, and I just want to get your feedback that it seems like you should have left in the term an additional, and then that would have made it pretty clear.
Madam Chair, Senator George, the guidance from the Housing and Urban Development Department on this issue, whether it's under state law or federal law, is that if a landlord charges a refundable deposit to all of their tenants, regardless of whether they have an assistance animal or no animal or whatever, they're still able to do that and to refund that based on the amount of cleaning or damage that they have to do. The reason that the language is done specifically the way it is that the deposit can't be charged on the basis of them having an animal, a service animal. So if there is a general fee or deposit, that is acceptable, but one cannot be charged specifically attributable to their use of a service animal.
So, Senator George and Senator Bonamici, I'll reiterate that, but say it slightly differently. It says they cannot be charged a fee or a deposit for the animal. It doesn't mean they cannot be charged fees or deposits just like all other tenants, but it cannot be an extra or a fee which is identified for the animal. But the tenant is still responsible for the behavior of the animal and any damage the animal does. Landlords have the same recourse they do there if it were a pet or if the tenant did the damage, not the animal.
Okay. I just want to make sure that was on the record because it's a little odd.
Right.
Crafted.
Any
Thank
other
you.
Questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. And then next we have Sybil Hebb and Bob Jundeff, please.
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the director of Disability Rights Oregon, and we're an organization that's funded to represent the interests of people with disabilities in terms of enforcing their civil rights across the state of Oregon. I'm here today because we did raise concerns about Senate Bill 875, and I just want to outline what they are, and I might actually address some of the questions that you've had. There is federal law and state law that specifically protects the civil rights of people with disabilities when it comes to housing. And part of the protection that it affords is for people who need assistance animals in order to conduct the daily activities of living, and that could be going to the supermarket, it could be living in a rental housing, all sorts of aspects of living. But it's limited to situations in which the person with disability needs that animal in order to participate in the activities of living. So for example, a person who is blind may need a guide dog in order to ambulate and make their way through society. When it comes to a tenancy, the animal is not considered, the way the law is structured, the federal law and the state law, the animal is not considered to be a pet. It's the animal is considered to be an essential part of that person's ability to live in society. And so the law treats it a little bit differently. And that's why, in this instance, in the questions that you had, if there is a fee that a landlord might charge for a pet, the law says a guide dog is not considered to be a pet. It's considered to be really an essential part of that person's ability to function. So just as if a tenant were to cause damage in an apartment through their own behavior, if the dog causes damage to that apartment, the same factors would apply. If there's a just general cleaning deposit or damage deposit that all tenants pay, that would appropriately cover damage by the animal because this animal is essentially considered to be part of that tenant. But fees that are designed to deal with pets, which we might define as an animal that's there for the enjoyment and recreation of the tenant, that doesn't apply to these situations. So That's why what disability, these disability laws are designed to do is to try to allow people with disabilities who have certain limitations to live in the same manner, as close to the same manner as other people in society. Now, as was noted earlier, the laws that we're dealing with in Senate Bill 875 are a little bit unusual because they're not in the disability discrimination portion of our state laws. However, from a perspective of protecting civil rights, one has to read them and how they comport with federal law, which is exactly why HUD was in conversation with the Bureau of Labor and Industry saying, by the way, you have a problem in your state statute because this particular statute restricts people's rights that are guaranteed by federal law. And we wholeheartedly support Senate Bill 875 in making sure that Oregon law doesn't narrow rights that people otherwise enjoy under federal law. What we noticed, however, was that in Section 3, the language of the protection only deals with people with physical impairments. Now, if you think about where ORS 346 is located, it is located in a chapter that just deals with people with physical impairments. And so one can understand why it only deals with that group of people. However, when taken on its face by itself, what it does is it says we recognize, this law recognizes that certain people with disabilities have these rights, but it doesn't mention other people with disabilities who have those same rights under federal law. So it's as if we have a law in Oregon that says we recognize that Group A can enjoy the benefits of the federal law, but we're not, but we don't say anything about the other groups that are protected by that same law. And that's why it got our attention, because we do have a law on our books that only extends protections under federal law to one group, but doesn't mention the other group. And so we had brought to the attention of the advocates of the bill to Boley, saying, well, if we're going to have a law that talks about these rights, why don't we make some amendments that say that all the groups that have, that enjoy these same rights under federal law, and just mention them all. We would actually prefer that to happen, and what that would mean is that, again, that rather than ORS 4, in Section 3, ORS 346-690 on line 27, that this did not only pertain to people with physical impairments, but we would prefer that it said to people with physical or mental impairments, because that's what the federal law says, and that is in fact what's protected by Chapter 659A in the civil rights portion of state law. And by the same token, we would add on line 28, where it says possession of an assistance animal, we would add possession of an assistance or companion animal, because again, our understanding is that there's different names for the types of animals we're talking about, but generally companion animal is the type of animal that comes into play when we're talking about people with psychiatric disabilities, because one of the common areas in which the law recognizes that a person with psychiatric disabilities may have a need for accommodation in their housing is to have a animal that provides them with emotional support. Now, I understand there's some controversy about this whole concept, but our understanding is that the federal law and the state law does protect that type of situation. And I might add, because the question was answered earlier, is that our understanding is that a landlord does not have to accept just the tenant's assertion that they have a disability, or the tenant's assertion that this is a companion animal, just on the face of it. A landlord has the right to ask for some kind of support, be it medical support, and it normally is, that this person does meet the definition of disability, and that this animal is essential, an essential accommodation for this person to enjoy living in their tenancy. So it's not just we're not talking about a open checkbook that a person could just claim to have an identity and a need, and that takes care of that. So the question that we brought to you is that we are of the opinion that if we're going to have a statute that talks about certain rights, that statute should accurately reflect the rights that are otherwise protected in state and federal law. That having been said, we understand that this passage of this bill is very important for Boley, and that HUD has given its direction that the changes need to be made in order for Boley to do its job. We don't want to interfere with that happening, but we do feel that state law should accurately reflect the rights of people with disabilities across the board.
Thank you, Bob. Sybil?
Thank you, Chair Bonamici and members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center. I also urge support of Senate Bill 875. We believe that it, as others have said, removes a clear inconsistency with federal law with respect to protections for people with physical disabilities. And so we very much are supportive of the bill. With respect to the amendments, I unfortunately have to confess that I am not a fair housing expert. I do believe it's a complicated area of the law. I don't know enough about companion animals and how those differ from assistance animals or what the definitions are, but I hear from Disability Rights Oregon as well as from the Fair Housing Council that these are appropriate standards for us to reflect. But I also and I should say that we're very supportive of principles of fair housing protection for people across the board, absolutely. But I also want to just raise that we are in sort of line with that, supportive of the relationships that we have had with landlords working on these issues over the past. And we hear from some of our partners that these are complicated areas that they have some concerns they would like to really assess. And so we honor that concern and would just want to take some time to take a closer look at what those amendments might look like. So, we again appreciate the work that's gone into them and the principles, and just have that perspective. So,
thank you. And in committee, it's my intention, and I know the sponsor of the bill is here, to make a commitment to continue to work on those issues, and maybe someday we can do an overhaul of the entire ORS to make sure that we get rid of some of these inconsistencies. But I think this is an important issue to get done for the equivalency, but I share your concerns and would be committed to working with you on making sure that that's clarified. Questions?
Madam Chair, I think I happen to be a landlord, and I actually came across a situation where I have a no pets policy, and someone came in with a very, very legitimate mental health claim with three dogs as companion animals. And so it was a difficult issue to deal with. So I think, there needs to be a serious discussion, but there also needs to be very clear delineation on what you're talking about.
Senator, I saw a story recently about someone who has a companion horse.
And Madam Chair, you could actually have someone who had a mental illness of hoarding animals. And then, I mean, things like this would, be very difficult to deal with.
But then what would happen if they had a companion exotic animal? Man, we'd be really in trouble, wouldn't we?
Senator Bonamici, Senator George, there is the term reasonable in front of the public.
Appreciate that. Any other questions? Thank you. Is there anyone else here who would like to testify on Senate Bill 875? I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 875 and open a work session on Senate Bill 875.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 875 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves Senate Bill 875 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? I'm going to ask for a roll call, even though Senator Girard is not here, just so we can tell him that we did it. The spirit is here.
Senator Burnett?
Aye.
Senator Girard?
Excused.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
Chair Bonamici?
Aye. Senate Bill 875 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Rosenbaum, would you please carry this bill?
I would be happy to.
All right. Thank you. Next, I'm going to open a work session on... Did we say that there was no fiscal revenue on... I'm going to reopen the work session on Senate Bill 875. Just clarify that we have no fiscal
number. Actually, the LFO, that was the one, Madam Chair, where LFO just revised the fiscal impact to minimal fiscal impact, no statement issued. At first was no fiscal impact.
Right. So. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Now I'll close again the work session on Senate Bill 875. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 685 and ask Lori to remind us what this does and tell us where we are in terms of paperwork, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 685 is the bill that prohibits the creditor from denying credit to an applicant solely because that applicant used a business address instead of a residential address if state law or local ordinance permits the use of that business address on their application for credit. You have before you a no revenue impact statement and, again, a minimal fiscal impact, no statement issue.
Thank you.
Amendment. Anyone motion?
I'm ready for a motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 685 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves Senate Bill 685 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Can we do a roll call vote, please?
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Gerard?
Excused.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
Chair Bonamici?
Aye. Senate Bill 685 moves to the floor with a two-pass recommendation, and I'm asking the sponsor of this bill, Senator Pozanski, to carry the bill. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 685. That does conclude our business for today. Committee, I would like to ask you to check your schedules next Thursday, a week from today. I would like to stay for some extra time to try to catch up on, you know, we're approaching our deadline. So I'd like you to get back to us as soon as possible to let us know if you can stay until 6 instead of 5 that day.
What day is that, Madam Chair?
The 9th. April 9th. That's your birthday?
It is.
Oh, man.
So it's not like you bring chocolate cake.
We will do that.
Celebrate your birthday.
We'll try to get through as much as we can, but I'm
we'll let you
try
carry
to
all the bills.
Catch up.
Very nice.
Catch up on some of the things because we have there's still some big things we're working on.
Are these mics on?
Oh, we're still in.
I haven't closed. Yeah. So there's still some big things we're working on. So if you'll check and get back to me, you'll let me know. Okay. Adjourn the committee for today. Thank you.
Are they off, man? You think just till 6?